Hello and welcome to the Stooshy, the politics podcast from TC Thompson Media. My name is Paul Malik. I'm the Courier's political editor, and I am joined this week from reporters around the UK. We have in London, joining us from Westminster, the Westminster correspondent for the Press and Journal, Dara Donoghue, and joining us from Aberdeen, the Evening Express's political correspondent, Adele Merson. Good morning to you both, how are we?
Good, thanks.
Not bad, Paul.
Excellent, excellent. Now, it's been another busy week in politics. I think I say that every week, but, you know, we wouldn't be doing this show if it wasn't busy. So we are pleased that we have plenty to talk about once again this week. And I think we'll start, as always, in Westminster. Now, there was a bit of shuffling about as part of the Westminster Union Unit. It was previously being held up until very recently by the former Ochil and South Perthshire MP Luke Graham. But he has been, has he been booted? Has he jumped? Has he left of his own accord? Dan, can you talk us through that one? It's quite an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this rumour started flying around at the start of this week. I mean, that Luke basically had been asked to leave the unit last week after Boris Johnson's trip north. This obviously set the hairs running, and everyone started kind of asking various questions of people in Number 10 and various sources in the Scottish Party. And eventually the story emerged that, I mean, I've had varying accounts of this. I mean, there was one story that suggested there was some blazing row last Friday, and it essentially centred on the strategy for the union, and Luke was not too happy with the way things were going. But then I've spoke to other people who said that this was more of a, it was a long-term thing, and it was a long time coming, that there was just a divergence really in kind of thought, and you know, there wasn't really, you know, I think Luke was brought in last August to try and kind of be that key figure in Number 10 and to kind of join up the departments in kind of having a centralised union strategy and an approach to handling things related to the Scottish Government and independence and all the rest of it. And, you know, people have told me that it's not really gone as was hoped. So, whether he jumped or he was pushed is still a bit up in the air. I mean, Luke is not really saying much at the moment. He's basically not wanting to. There was some rumours that he was going to kind of go and work for the Scottish Party. And there was also rumours flying around that he was going to get on the regional list for the Tories and run for the Tories in May's elections. But, I mean, both of those things have been strongly dismissed to me, certainly, by senior people in the Scottish Party have said, you know, that's not going to happen. So who knows where he will end up next? I mean, all I can say is, you know, he is a very nice chap, and he's always been very, you know, on hand for Scottish Westminster journalists since he arrived last August. His replacement, I mean, they were quick to kind of move someone else into that role. It's this guy called Oliver Lewis, who has variously been described as Dominic Cummings' protege. He basically kind of worked under David Frost, who headed up all the Brexit negotiations. He was his kind of deputy, kind of hammering out the details on stuff like that. And it's been said to me that, you know, Oliver is a bit more of a, not aggressive, but he's a bit more attack-minded in his thinking. I mean, he was the guy who, I mean, I've been told that he was the guy who came up with all that hoo-ha a couple of years ago about ripping up the Northern Ireland protocol. And obviously there was all the threats of legal action and successful legal action, actually, over that decision. So, you know, that gives you a bit of background as to who he is and, I suppose, where Number 10 are moving, you know, in the kind of plan to try and take the fight to the SNP. I mean, I've been told at the moment that he's going to kind of sit in the background a bit and kind of just have more informal chats with kind of Scottish Tories, Scottish Party, kind of reviewing a bit of a stock take where Number 10 is, what policies there are, you know, what MPs and MSPs are feeling about the direction of travel. And then basically he's going to kick into action after the Holyrood election, and he will start kind of, you'll probably see him start pulling the strings a bit more. I mean, obviously the SNP have made a lot of hay of this, saying that, you know, Vote Leave have kind of moved in and are now headed up the union strategy, and that just shows how much, you know, Boris Johnson's really out of touch with Scotland. But yeah, it's all drama as usual down here, Paul.
So that, I mean, that is an interesting one. On the one hand, you speak to any number of Scottish Conservative MSPs, and they'll tell you how unpopular Dominic Cummings is in terms of their own hopes for getting re-elected in May. And yet, it would seem that Westminster are choosing someone, I suppose you could say, with a track record, who's actually won a referendum. And I suppose it didn't, you know, they might have won the vote in 2014, but there was nothing definitive about the fact that the Better Together won, because we're still talking about it, you know, 6-7 years later. So that is an interesting choice. Is there anything to suggest that he would use the same sort of tactics that Vote Leave use in favour of the union, you know, being a bit more positive or being a bit more sort of out of the box thinking, which we didn't get from either the Remain or Better Together during either of the referendum campaigns?
Well, I mean, I've not heard any plans for a big union flag painted bus to go up to Scotland yet with various promises about how much money I'll be given to the NHS or by the consequentials or anything like that. But I mean, I think certainly from, you know, I mean, I've not spoken to Oliver myself, but I mean, people who know him have told me that, you know, he is someone who will kind of, as I say, go on a bit more of a front-footed approach towards the SNP. And, you know, he will be a bit more, well, again, proactive, I suppose, in kind of rebutting things or, you know, pointing things out. I mean, it's been pointed out to me this, you know, because I've been working on a couple of kind of background pieces as to what's going on in Number 10 that, that'll be out, I think, over the weekend. And some of the people I've been speaking to have kind of said that Number 10 really are overreaching to a degree in kind of setting up. You know, you've got the union unit, you've got the union task force, which we don't hear about anymore. You've got Michael Gove's union committee. You've got, obviously, Boris Johnson is the minister for the union. Then you've got the Scotland office pitching in, and you've got the Scottish Party. So, you know, there's been a bit of a sense from some to say that, you know, it's kind of a too many cooks spoil the broth type thing, and, you know, Number 10 needs to just butt out a bit and leave it to kind of Douglas Ross and his team to approach this issue. But I mean, you know, as I say, I think at the moment, certainly they're letting the Scottish Party get on with fighting the Holyrood elections. And then depending on how that goes, you will probably see and hear Oliver Lewis's name a lot more in the months ahead.
And speaking of Douglas Ross, Adele, you were covering a story this week, which was quite interesting. Douglas Ross has decided to campaign on the idea that it's not the time to talk about IndyRef 2, but he then offered the First Minister a debate on independence. You've been following that story this week. Can you talk us through a bit about that?
Yeah, he broadcast a speech on Facebook regarding the union in response to the SNP's roadmap to independence, which was a sort of 11-point plan on how they hope to achieve independence. As you say, his speech kind of started with, we shouldn't be debating, you know, right now is the time to be focusing on the COVID-19 pandemic, and instead the First Minister is pursuing independence and sort of being critical of that. But then goes on to say that he wanted to challenge her to a debate this month. He said it would be a one-on-one debate with a mutual referee who would post questions to the two of them on Scotland's constitutional future. The First Minister was asked about this at her daily briefing on Monday, and she said that Douglas Ross was at risk of making himself look a bit silly because of what we've just said, because he said he didn't want to speak about independence and then in the same breath is challenging her to debate on independence. You know, she said, as you'd expect her to, she's 100% focused on leading the country through the pandemic, but Mr. Ross made the point that, in his opinion, she isn't too busy for this debate, that she wasn't too busy to authorise this 11-point plan or to set up the task force on independence, and that therefore, if she's going to do that, then she should face him in this debate. You know, the roadmap, just a bit of background on that, that the roadmap that the SNP published says that a legal referendum will be held after the pandemic if there is a pro-independence majority following May's election, and that they would vigorously oppose any legal challenge from the UK government to this. We had a sort of virtual huddle, the journalists, after, and he was asked about this and whether, you know, the UK government would take legal action in reverse almost against the Scottish government, and if they were to pursue the referendum. And, you know, he just kind of said that he doesn't think the UK government should be taking, you know, taking any part in this petty politics, as he called it. So yes, it doesn't sound like this debate is happening this month, to be honest.
Well, that's a shame. And Nicola Sturgeon and Douglas Ross, if you are listening, which I'm sure you are, feel free to come on the Stushy and we can have the debate here and now, and Dan and Adele and I can lead you through some of the most important questions, including what are your thoughts on Sunday evenings. Speaking of manoeuvres, it would seem that the SNP have been on a rather small but significant clear out of the front bench at Westminster, Dan, with Joanna Cherry rather unceremoniously dumped from her position as Shadow Home Secretary, and she now has been left without a portfolio, it would seem. It's been sort of one of the most open secrets in Scottish politics for a while that Joanna Cherry is on, or would appear to be on, the side of the salmon side, would appear to be on the Alex Salmond side of the Sturgeon-Salmon divide, which is currently ripping the party, whether or not they like to admit it or not, and that she also has her eyes set on the leadership position. There's been a bit of a development that you've been working on Thursday and Friday, Dan, regarding the Scottish Affairs Committee and Joanna Cherry, and the possibility that she could be placed and replace one of our own MPs, Perth's Pete Wisher, as chair of said committee. Can you explain a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, so, I mean, this obviously has been quite a dramatic week for the SNP. As you say, you know, there was kind of all sorts of late-night briefings going on Monday. You know, senior SNP sources were phoning me at kind of 8, 9 o'clock at night saying, you know, that Miss Cherry had kind of been moved on because of a long-standing pattern of unacceptable behaviour, and they allege that, you know, SNP MPs were kind of in tears by some of the things she'd said in the past and kind of some of her behaviour on social media. There was apparently, you know, some kind of threat to call a vote of no confidence on Monday morning, and before that, the SNP Westminster leader Ian Blackford kind of stepped in and just took action, basically, and said, you know, that she was off the shadow front bench team. You know, she obviously reacted in the way she did on social media. You know, this week there's kind of been, you know, various kind of, you know, leaked stories about kind of, you know, what next for the Edinburgh MP. And I mean, I don't know if it's just a bit of mischief making. I mean, certainly that's what some people have told me, but On Thursday morning, every Thursday, there's a meeting of the Common Scottish Affairs Committee. They carry out kind of various inquiries into different issues. And before the official kind of public start of the committee, there's kind of a mini private session where, you know, usually it's just kind of administrative stuff where MPs can, you know, raise various little issues in private. And somebody, with knowledge of what was said there, has told me that there was a bit of disquiet over the fact that in this kind of reshuffle at the start of the week in which Miss Cherry lost her job, Pete Wishart, who's the chairman of the Scottish Affairs Committee, was kind of given this shadow leader of the Commons brief. And he was asking his colleagues on the committee whether they would be up for rearranging the time of the committee meetings, because it would now clash with his new responsibilities. So there was a bit of annoyance, and people said, well, look, you know, you get paid extra to be a committee chairman. Perhaps, you know, why don't you stand down? You know, and Joanna Cherry, she's now free. Why can't she take over? I mean, this, you know, this has kind of been a bit, you know, poo-pooed by the party. And as I say, it's been called, you know, mischief making on behalf of the Tories. But, you know, there are people who are on that wing of the party in the SNP, and You know, people are making the point and saying, well, you know, the Scottish Affairs Committee job is a full-time role. Why, if you've got someone of the calibre of Joe Cherry, you know, who's a QC, a very experienced MP, you know, forensic examiner of people in various committees, you know, why shouldn't she have an opportunity to do that role? So I don't know. I mean, it's obviously just another front in this kind of factional war between different SNP MPs that I'm sure we'll be talking about for a very long time.
Oh, very, very interesting indeed. Speaking of other odd things that have happened this week, Del, you've been covering the Hollywood debate, which took place earlier this week on Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, I should say, not Donald Trump Jr., although he is inexplicably tied to this, I'm sure. I am, of course, talking about the debate around the order of an unexplained wealth order. Adele, could you explain what an unexplained wealth order is, first of all, and whether or not the Scottish Government will be pursuing one against Mr. Trump?
Yeah, so MSPs have rejected calls for the Scottish Government to investigate Donald Trump's business interests in Scotland. The Scottish Greens have brought forward the motion, which called for the investigation via an unexplained wealth order. Patrick Harvey, the Scottish Greens co-leader, has repeatedly called on the First Minister to look into what he says are serious and evidenced concerns surrounding how the former president purchased both the land acquired for his first golf course, which is in the mini estate in Balmeddy, Aberdeenshire, and the luxury Turnberry Golf Resort in Ayrshire. So that's kind of... In response to that, the Justice Secretary, Hamza Youssef, said that it would really be for the Civil Recovery Unit, that's a branch of the Crown Office, to independently undertake the investigation sort of role that's associated with civil recovery. So this would be unexplained wealth orders are for sort of civil cases rather than criminal, and that the CIU should do that on behalf of Scottish ministers. So Mr. Youssef's argument was really that it's important that there be this separation of powers between obviously a government and a justice system. And he said that the unexplained wealth order is really a tool that can lead to law enforcement action. And I guess questioned really whether it's compatible for the rule of law for, you know, any law enforcement process, be that civil or criminal, to be directed by politicians. So that was kind of the argument that won at the end of the day. Whereas, I mean, there does seem to be conflicting legal advice. It's a bit of a muddy area because, you know, Patrick Harvey said the move that it is for ministers to initiate this unexplained wealth order and that the move isn't one for prosecution, but really just about asking a court to seek answers to what he says are reasonable questions over his business dealings.
I mean, it's safe to say that the mini, I am pronouncing that right, Adele. I mean, it is mini estate, it's not many estate. I have made that mistake in the past.
I say mini.
It's mini. Well, you're from the area, so we'll go with mini. It's fair to say that that's, and also the Turnberry course as well in the south of Scotland are controversial to say the least. But would residents in Aberdeenshire be surprised, or really surprised that there had been sort of ill-gotten gains that had produced Mr. Trump's golf course? Or would it just be of course it is. Everything else has been so odd about this development.
I don't think they'd be surprised that there's questions being asked around it. There's quite a lot of, to put it lightly, there was a lot of ill feeling amongst residents that live in that area. We did get a statement actually from Sarah Malone, who is the Executive Vice President of Trump International in Aberdeenshire. And she said it was an utter waste of parliamentary time, in her opinion. And she accused Patrick Harvey of grandstanding at a critical time in the global pandemic and saying that, it was a waste of time, basically. So
there you go. And if there's one company that knows about grandstanding and waste of time, I'm sure it's the Trump company. Moving on, we have had quite a lot of debate, as per every show we've done for the past year, on the coronavirus. Now that we have the vaccines, now that the vaccine rollout seems to be gathering pace, or as the First Minister put it on Thursday, motoring through, Scotland has delivered well more than 700,000 vaccines. I'm sure we're going to get an update later today that will make this number obsolete, but by our own calculations, we should have, by Friday morning, which is when this will be recorded, given 700,000 doses of the vaccine to people in the country. And that includes 98% of older care home residents, includes about 90% of care home staff, and they think over 90% now of over 80s in the community, which means that we're moving on to the sort of next phase, which is slightly younger, people aged between 70 and 79, and others on the GCVI priority list. Now, what's been sort of focusing the attention is the comparable rates between the UK four nations and how quickly each country has been able to deliver the jab. I think it's safe to say that England, well, it's not just safe to say, it is statistically correct to say that England seems to have the fastest rollout rate while Scotland has the slowest, but it's one of those ones where arguments will be made throughout as to how important just having a speed rate and measuring that is. We know that down in Westminster, the response to the coronavirus and the public's attitude to the way the government responded to the coronavirus has been mostly negative. Boris Johnson isn't really deemed to have handled it all that well, and a lot of the people surrounded or surrounding him in office are also sort of seeing their popularity wane. But is this different for vaccines? Is the vaccine rollout being seen as more of a success than, say, the overall handling of the pandemic down south?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say so. I mean, the figures are quite astounding, really. I think it's kind of around 10 million people have now been vaccinated, and they're on course to hit the target. I think that's the first time we can actually say that with any targets in this pandemic. Hitting the target of vaccinating 15 million by mid-February. Certainly from what I've heard, people I know have been offered the vaccine in certain age groups, and it certainly is being meted with a lot more happiness than a lot of kind of some of these missed targets that we've had over the last couple of months. And who knows how that'll kind of bear out long term on Boris Johnson's popularity.
And Adele, and similar sort of north of the border, it seems that Nicola Sturgeon's handling, or the perceived handling of the way that she's dealt with the pandemic, has stood her in good stead. It looks like she's on course for another victory during the Holyrood elections in May. And yet the vaccine's rollout does seem to be slower than the other four nations, Northern Ireland, Wales and England. Do we think this will have any impact at all, really, on how she's perceived to have been handling the coronavirus in general?
I mean, it is, I think, questioning the speed of the rollout is important, because when these vaccines were first starting to come out, the First Minister did say that we are now sort of in the phase where it's a race between the virus and the vaccine. So that language was used, like, that is the situation we're in. We're living under really tough restrictions. And so I think pace is important. The quicker you get the vaccine in your arm, the quicker you get protection and less people die. So I don't think there's any sort of debate really over whether pace is important. But in terms of the First Minister, I think, she has such high approval ratings and has continued to be popular throughout this pandemic, I think in big part because the public seem to have a respect for, her communication skills, her daily briefings. And so, to be honest, I don't think, being slightly slower than England and the other nations will really dent her popularity at all, if I'm honest.
Interesting stuff. Now, those of you who follow politics Twitter will have no doubt seen the absolutely wild video that has surfaced of a community council meeting in the small Cheshire East town of Handforth. Adele and Dan, I know you both know what I'm talking about. Standing orders and following them and learning the rules. I'm sure are about to become sort of big internet memes over the next wee while. And more importantly, they kind of reflect sometimes some of the weirder council meetings that you will no doubt have sat through in your time as reporters and editors and journalists in politics, guys. Have you? You've seen the video first and foremost, so I'm not going down a rabbit hole, am I?
No, we absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. I mean, I would advise anybody who hasn't just to get onto Twitter, social media, and punch it in and have a look. I mean, it's well worth your time. It's crazy.
I mean, I know I feel like I've met characters like that before in village halls and little town centres, across Dundee and Perth and Fife. I'll not name any names because they no doubt will write in and say how dare you. But Adele, you must have come across similar types of characters as well. Just really angry for the sake of being angry.
Yeah, there can be some really strange power dynamics, I think, in these. What you think would be fairly. I mean, I should preface this, but they do a lot of good work, and you know they give up their time to do it. So in that sense, I respect all that. But yeah, there are some strange power dynamics, power struggles, I would say. But yeah, I mean, I was a former council reporter, and so I probably have countless stories off that I can't quite get them to mind. But no, I remember one in particular where. Quite a sad one, actually, where I was a brand new reporter and I went to a community council meeting. Again, I'm not going to name what community council it was. And the chairman was a formidable man. I was terrified of him. And he kind of asked me to come and speak to him. And he basically gave me a bollocking for not introducing that I had been there, I think that was the question. I then went home and cried.
Oh, because no, it had been no.
So horrible. So yeah, they definitely, I think that was just my lack of experience and also how scary he was. But yeah, I think they can be interesting places for sure.
I've had a chairman of a community council on several occasions phone me up and tell me I'm a terrible reporter. Which is fair enough, really. Because
well, you're a terrible councillor, mate. You should have said.
He wasn't even a councillor. That's the thing. It's these people just self-appointed. It was amazing. So with that in mind, I think this week's Stooge of the Week can only go to the angrier members of Handforth Parish Council, and a special sort of well done anti-Stooge of the Week to Jackie Weaver, who seemed to handle it in her stride, despite the fact that she didn't have the authority.
Stooge of the Week.
On that note, I've been Paul Malik. Thanks to Dan Donahue and Adele Merson for joining me this week on The Stooshy. We will join you at the same Stoosh time, the same Stoosh place on your podcast provider next week. Goodbye.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.